The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back with Sports Talk New York here on WGBB in Merrick, Long Island, New York. I'm very happy you can be with us on this Sunday evening on Long Island. The Mets win one today, which is a rarity. They didn't really make you run to New York Presbyterian to get through it, too, which was a happy event for all, for Met fans. And the Knickerbockers, of course, eliminated from playoff competition by the Indiana Pacers, but they had a really good season and a lot to look forward to. It was nice to see the alumni of the New York Knicks out there at the game today lending some support to today's Knickerbockers. Well, our next guest, he's worked in sports media for the past 45 years. Howie is a sports update anchor at SiriusXM, and he's an accredited Major League Baseball official scorer here in New York. He's worked on numerous radio stations as an anchor and reporter and has authored or co-authored 14 books. He's a columnist for NewYorkSportsDay.com and a contributor to Baseball Digest. His book is titled 976-1313, How Sports Phone Launched Careers and Broke New Ground. We welcome to Sports Talk New York tonight, Howie Carpin. Howie, good evening.
Pleasure to be with you, Bill. Appreciate it.
Nice to have you, Howie. Now, I want to mention right off the bat that you have a co-author on this project, Scott. Tell us a little bit about Scott.
Yeah, Scott O'Jara is my partner in this project, a very talented guy. He handled half the writing, a lot of the writing with, you know, that didn't involve the actual sports phone people, but the callers and some of the outliers that we wrote about in the book, and how some places, you know, did scores and things like that. But Scott formatted the book. As you see, the cover is beautiful, and he just did a great job. It was a pleasure working with him on this project.
Yes, as you say, a very talented young man, Scott is. And the foreword, folks, on this book is written by Kenny Albert. Correct, Howie?
Yeah, he was excited to do it when I asked him if he wanted to. He was thrilled, you know, to be involved with this, and we were glad to have him along because, as you read in the book, he was one of the main callers for the sports phone quickie quiz when he was younger.
Yeah, that is great. Now, for folks that may not remember or are too young to remember, get all the sports news instantly. Dial 976-1313 was the tagline. Tell the folks exactly what Sports Phone was, Howie.
Well, it was the pioneer for what you have today on the phone, Bill, and you know, and the computer. It was an instant access to the scores. Obviously, the gamblers were the bread and butter, you know, for Sports Phone.
Right.
But the people that worked at Sports Phone treated it like a sports radio station. Although you didn't get a live update when you called in, you got a recording, but the recordings were updated every 10 minutes on a regular night. And then on NFL Sunday, we went to two-minute updates where they had to bring in four anchors for each hour. There were 15-minute shifts for each hour because you did an update, you came back out, got your scores, and went back in. It was very fast-moving, but it was... For most people, it was the only place to get the scores unless you waited for WCBS or wins at the quarter after quarter two, or the newspaper the next day, or the 11 o'clock news maybe had, they wouldn't have the out-of-town scores. They were lucky to get the local stuff. And Sports Phone had, you know, we had a Chicago and Detroit office, and we had a number of lines that came out of New York, including Atlanta, Buffalo, Rochester. So it gave a lot of young broadcasters opportunities to polish their craft. You know, you worked with a slate, what we call the slate, where you got your scores, and it wasn't a predetermined script you basically ad-libbed each tape because you weren't reading words, you were reading numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave a lot of people the training ground to move on to other things. And you saw the alumni list is extensive, and I was proud to be a little part of it.
Yeah, it's like a who's who in broadcasting, Howie. And again, I'll reiterate, there was no internet. Nothing on television except for the 6 o'clock, the 11 o'clock news. There was no way to get a score at your fingertips right now. You couldn't sign on to the internet. So you'd go to Sports Phone, and everything was out there. And like Howie says, updated every 10 minutes. Where did you guys reside, so to speak, Howie?
Well, my main tenure was at 3rd Avenue. I don't know if you know B.J. Clark's on 55th and 3rd.
Sure.
it was a building right there above B.J. Clark's. And then in 1989, they moved the operation out to Elmont, New York, right near Belmont. And I was there until 92, and then Don LaGreca took it over until 2000, or from 93 to about 2000. They ended up, you know, moving out of Elmont and into a small place in New Jersey until it went under in 2000. But having it in Manhattan was great. You know, you're right in the middle of everything, and, you know, we were able to, we actually got a couple of stories down at P.J. Clark's where we broke some news. But, you know, you're right in the hustle and bustle right there. So it was pretty rewarding to be working in Manhattan, you know, the main media center where I spent, I was there from 80 to 89 and then out to Elmont for a couple of years.
We're talking to Howie Carpin tonight about his book about Sports Phone, 976-1313. Who were the original guys on Sports Phone, Howie?
Well, it came into existence in 1972. Didn't really take off. As you read in the book, it tells you the background. Until 1975, Guy LeBeau, who was a, you know, sports broadcaster on ABC, WABC TV, he was the one that really got it going. And it began with Mike Walczewski, who's now the Garden PA announcer for the Knicks. He was known as King Wally, so he was the main voice that you heard during the day on New York Sports Phone. Obviously, the New York line was the gold standard. I mean, if you got on New York, it was a big deal. You know, they didn't just put you on there right away. They put you on the other lines, like New Jersey and Atlanta, and, you know, Rod, that's where you really got your training. And then if you were good enough, they put you on New York. So once you got on New York, you knew that you were doing well there. And King Wally everybody knew King Wally because he was on Monday to Friday in the afternoons. When you had a lot of features and breaking news, only during baseball season, you had scores during the weekday afternoons. Otherwise, the gist of the scores was at night and on the weekends. You know, baseball was the main thrust in the summer, but we had college basketball Saturday night where we had like a total of 90 games we were covering throughout the day. We had three lines where we moved the finals once they ran on the main line to supplemental lines. In case somebody wanted a score from the afternoon, they'd have to call those other lines to get it, because obviously you can only fit a certain amount. Hey, but and then college football on Saturday afternoon, that was a big deal, and then the NFL. But baseball, like, you know, took us into the weekday afternoons on occasion. This was actually my idea. We actually sent somebody out to the ballpark where they would actually do the tape into a phone itself.
Right.
When we did it in the studio, it was like a little closet studio. It was really small. You had a microphone and a sound setup, a board, and the phone. So you dialed a number into the phone. You got beeps, and there was a cue beep. And then when you got your cue, you recorded, and then you ended it with a cue beep, I think on the asterisk. And then it would load for the people that called in every 10 minutes. But we sent somebody out to the ballpark to get an ambiance, you know, get the crowd from the ball game going on while you were doing your tape. The person would call into the central, you know, place where the scores were accumulated. They'd get their scores, and they'd do the actual Sports Phone update from the ballpark.
Yeah, I remember that. Guys on site. That was definitely added a great touch to it. Now, there were females on Sports Phone as well.
Yeah, Shelley Adler, who ended up on AP, and she was like, She was one of the first women voices we had. Linda Cohn worked for me. Obviously, everyone knows what she's done with her career.
That's my college classmate from Oswego, Howie.
Yeah, she was great. Cohen. I mean, yeah. You know, she had the background, and she was very talented, and obviously she moved on to bigger and better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were some women that did it back then. I don't think there weren't a lot of women that really grew up with sports like they do today. Obviously, there are a lot more women involved, and more they have more of a history with sports than they did in those days. But they fit in, you know. It was a little awkward for the guys a little bit, admittedly. But, you know, they were good. They were talented. They knew their stuff. They had to know their stuff. The guys, too. I mean, you know, you had people there who knew their sports. We had some great discussions in the newsroom, some really interesting debates back and forth. So people were serious about what they were doing. So, you know, like Linda was terrific, especially on hockey. She knew a lot of hockey, still mm-hmm. does today. You know, Shelley was very talented. So, yeah, I mean, anyone who was there was pretty talented, or else you wouldn't have lasted.
Right. How about getting a job there? What did folks have to do to audition?
Well, like for radio stations, I was fortunate because when I met, I actually interned at WMCA when I was trying to break into business, and I met Art Rush Jr. You remember him, right?
Yeah, right.
Art Rush Jr. Right. So anyway, sports talk radio had gone out of vogue in the late 70s. WMCA dropped it. There were no sports talk shows. But they brought it back on a Saturday, once a week basis, and Art was the host. So I asked, I was interning there, and I asked if I could work on the show, and they let me work there. And then Art got me credentials to cover Yankee games and things like that. And I met I met Mike Farrell, who was the boss at that time. And I just happened to get in at the right time because they were expanding and looking for people. And they brought me on and, you know, eventually worked my way up to supervisor and spent 12 years there. So that, you know, that's part of the book for the young people who don't know, who never really, you know, dealt with sports phone. That's part of the lure for them to read this book to see how people got their starts and how they broke into the business and how they moved on from there.
Right. Start low, aim high is the advice for the kids out there. The callers, were there any colorful callers that you knew, like there were on The Fan, like Doris from Rego Park and Jerome from Brooklyn and people like that? And any profiles on the callers?
The ones that called into the quickie quiz beside Kenny, there was a guy named Laser Lubin, I remember. He was always, you know, calling into the quickie quiz. Obviously, we didn't interact with the callers directly
because
we were on a recording. Although later on there became a thing called Sports Phone Live, where there was a live anchor who could handle, like, I think 30 to 35 calls at one time when people really wanted instant, you know, access, to where that anchor was actually giving them updates without doing play-by-play, obviously, you know, for that would be a rights issue. But, you know, they'd ask for a certain score, and then that person would give them the score right away. And it was almost like, I don't know if you used to watch Monty Python.
Oh, yeah.
They had a blackmail skit where the fee would run up on the guy as long as the film kept going. Well, on Sports Phone Live, as long as you stayed on live, the longer you stayed on, the higher your bill was. But for people, it was worth it because they didn't have to dial in and get the recording. They'd actually get somebody telling them the scores. So that was actual interaction with the callers, but the people who are on Sports Phone itself never really interacted with the callers.
Right. I was working for a while the night shift at Merrill Lynch in their tech center, and we used to have a direct ring down. You could pick up the phone anytime and get Sports Phone dialed directly. And that was the period when I believe Bud Harrelson was managing the Mets, and they were in it with the Pirates for a race for the division crown. And everybody was interested in keeping up with the scores. And you'd hear, you know, Darryl Strawberry just homered and the Mets are ahead 3-2 or something like that. And intricate part of the evening. Now, there was sort of a family tree between WFUV and WNYU.
Yeah, well, with King Wally, Brad, so he was the connection for FUV. You know, they had their own radio station, and they got, you know, really you know, a terrific training ground for them. NYU was the same. We had a guy named Alan Sanders, Rich Ackerman, Kenny Albert came out of NYU. And, you know, it was college kids looking to break in. Obviously, you weren't making a whole lot of money. You made a little salary. You made some money on the side while they were going to classes. And, you know, they used to bust their butts because they'd work some night shifts and then go to class in the day. So it wasn't easy on them. I was already out of school at the time. Mm-hmm. So luckily, you know, that worked out well for me. But, yeah, I mean, college kids were all over the place coming into sports farm because it was a good opportunity for them to be in a professional setting and get their training.
Right. The Hollywood connections to sports farm, tell us about those, Howie.
Yeah, well, Phone Programs, which was the governing company of Sports Phone, they did other things. They put out lines, you know, for certain actors. Like there was a line for Jazzy Jeff, and that's how they branched out into Hollywood. We had a guy named Mike Weinstein who now works for Lionsgate in California.
Wow.
He was involved with you know, Will Smith,
yeah,
and Jazzy Jeff. And you know, they did certain lines, you know, I think I was gone already in 94, but they had a line for OJ in 94 when that was going on with the trial and everything. So they branched out into different facets besides sports because they did other kinds of lines. They had some celebrities do Dial a Joke, and unfortunately, well, I won't say unfortunately, but there was some pornographic lines too, you know, that they worked on and stuff.
Sure.
We didn't work on that, thankfully, but you know, it was there for people if they wanted it.
Yeah, 976. That was like the first lines that you could get something like that. They mentioned it on Seinfeld where Kramer's calling 976 numbers. So that was famous for that, Howie. We're speaking with Howie Carpin tonight on Sports Talk New York about his book and about Sports Phone, the evolution of it, the beginnings. It's called 976-1313. Now, the evolution of Sports Phone and its tie into the fan. Tell us about that, Howie.
Well, once Fan came in, Sports Phone was going to be kind of obsolete because, look, Fan was free, you know, and obviously people, you know, had a problem with their phone bills if they were running up their bill.
Right.
So after a while, you know, once Fan came in, it was going to be obsolete. I'll tell you a little story about that. When they first started, they didn't want to hire any sports phone people. They considered us competition, even though we weren't the competition. But even so, I mean, wouldn't you hire some of the competition that knew how to handle, you know, doing the updates and
yeah,
things like that? So
I would, you know, think they, so.
Yeah, but so a lot of us really didn't get a fair shake in that regard. And a lot of talented people had to move on to do other things. Like, you know, Steve Torrey went on to win, Steve Cangelosi went on to wins. Bob Papa went on to WNEW when they were doing a show called The Sports Connection, and then he ended up with the radio job for the Giants.
Mm-hmm.
So the talent found its way into the business, even though Fan was really a roadblock for many of us.
Yeah, understood about that, Howie. Now, what signaled the end for Sports Phone?
Well, again, Fan and then, you know, ESPN, the ticker, and then obviously, you know, the advent of the internet and cell phones. You know, sports phone just, you know, became obsolete. It was lucky that it lasted as long as it did to the year 2000 because, you know, people just weren't calling it anymore. Once they got, you know, other ways of getting scores, you know, they had the instant access with the internet and cell phone and stuff like that. So, you know, sports phone just essentially became obsolete.
Tell us a couple of good stories about Sports Phone, Howie, that I don't want you to sell the book down the river, so we want people to go get it. But give us an example of a couple of good stories from the book.
All right, well, you know, we used to try to break our own news by you know, it's funny, we worked at Sports Phone, and the way to get news was using the phone. So on the night that Wayne Gretzky set the 50 goals and 50 game record, I think he said it in his 39th game. They were in Edmonton in 81. He scored, five goals that night to set the record. He broke Mike Bossy's record. Bossy had done it before that. So we decided to try to call the Northlands Coliseum. I was working with a guy named Pat Harris. So I said, Pat, why don't you try and call Edmonton. Let's see. Maybe, who knows? Maybe we'll get Gretzky. So Pat Harris called the Northlands Coliseum, got the switchboard operator, says, can you direct the locker room? And she, transmitted the locker room. So she did. And sure enough, who picks up the phone? The coach, Glenn Sather.
Right.
So Pat says, yeah, we're trying to get Gretzky on a phone. Or he said, and you know, he could call us collect because we had a toll-free line, but from Canada, you had to call collect.
Yeah.
So he gave Glenn Sather the number, and Sather said, I'll make it a point to get him the message. So about 45 minutes later, we get a call collect from Wayne Gretzky. Pat picked it up. But it was two of our guys goofing around in the other room, you know, making believe it was Gretzky. So they kind of pulled a fast one on Pat. Then that happened again about 20 minutes later. And again, it was the same two guys, fooling around. Then it happened a third time. And Pat didn't want to pick up the phone. I said, Pat, come on, pick up the phone. You never know. Picks up the phone. It's Gretzky.
There you go.
So we interviewed him. We had our own news. And here's a follow-up to that story. Pat went to an event like 3-4 years later and introduced himself to Gretzky, and Gretzky goes, yeah, you're the guy on the phone I called collect.
Yeah, he remembered. Oh, that's a good one.
And then there was a couple of times we called Muhammad Ali and we got in touch with him. One time we talked to him in the hospital.
Oh, man. That's
and
great.
Then one time we talked to him, I think, I forgot where he was. It's in the book. I forgot where he was doing. He was getting ready for a fight. It may have been against Trevor Berbick. I'm not sure if he was in Jamaica or something like that. We got in touch. We tried to call Trevor Berbick, and we ended up with Ali, and we interviewed Ali a couple of times on the phone.
Not too shabby, yeah. It pays off, definitely. Howie Carpin with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, one particular chapter from the book that I was curious about was Bruno, Captain Lou, and Iron Mike. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, well, that was the wrestling line. That was a separate entity that actually came out of the same office. There was a guy named Blackjack Brown who was very involved with the wrestling scene, and that became a very popular line. So he was actually working in the same office as us, and he had an interactive line also, like Sports Phone Live, where he would talk to, like, get a lot of people on a phone call, and they would cover it when it was WrestleMania and things and events like that. That was a big deal. So they got Lou Albano involved, I think, with a commercial, and the Iron Sheik was also involved. I wasn't big on wrestling, so that was separate from Sports Phone, but that came out of the same offices.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine. There's a lot of people into that, so that would have done well for sure. Now, I forgot my train of thought now, Howie. I noticed there's a bill, a phone bill in the book. How did you guys get that, and whose bill was it, and what kind of bill did they run up?
Well, that Scott Orgiera got that. He was we were researching, old articles and things to look for things about Sports Phone. And I don't know if you remember the BC scandal, the point shaving scandal in the early 80s.
Right.
Late 1981, I think it was. So Pat ran into this article and it happened to mention Sports Phone. So Pat got in touch with the federal agent and the prosecutor. The movie Goodfellas, the federal agent plays himself. He's in that movie. I don't know his name. His name was Ed something. Mm-hmm. So Scott interviewed him, and we got permission to reprint these phone records that they used to implicate Henry Hill, the character in Goodfellas, right? Yeah, because they were calling Sports Phone for the BC scores, obviously to see, what their work was doing as far as the point shaving and stuff, making big bets on it. They used that against Henry Hill in the case, luckily they allowed us to reprint those, phone records. And if you look at those records, you see all the calls to Sports Phone. There's about 40 lines of 9761313. Well, they used that to implicate Henry Hill and later on Jimmy Burke, the character that Robert De Niro played in Goodfellas.
Yeah.
That's how they snagged him, on a charge, because they got Henry Hill to kind of like rat him out, because they backed him into a corner with those phone records and got him implicated in these point shaving scandal. Although they didn't those didn't think they were doing anything wrong. They didn't think it was a crime, but it was a crime.
Yeah.
And you can see this phone records tells you because they ended up calling sports phones. So we thought that was pretty nifty to put that in there.
Definitely, yeah, that's a great ad, Howie, that is for sure. Now, in the book, folks, you can see in the beginning the alumni, as we spoke about in the sports phone. There's guys like Rich Ackerman, who was a longtime update guy on The Fan, Steve Cangelosi, Chris Carino, the voice for the Nets, Gary Cohen, Linda Cohen, as I said, my classmate from SUNY Oswego, Jack Curry from the Yes Network, and it just goes on and on. You have any upcoming events, Howie, that you could tell the folks about?
Well, there's been whispers of maybe a documentary. I don't know if that's going to come off, but we don't really have anything planned right now. You know, the book's been out less than a month. It's gotten some really positive feedback. We're really proud and flattered. You know, everyone who reads it says they can't put it down, so I guess that's the ultimate compliment. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. I mean, we may have some book signings, nothing right now. You know, again, we'll see where it goes. And if a documentary ever comes out of it, we have a guy, I don't know his name offhand, who worked with those kind of things. He worked at Sports Phone in the early days, and he kind of brought that up. He said this would be great for a documentary, maybe one of those 30 for 30 type thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we own the rights to the book. It's self-published through a publisher. You know, Scott and I own the rights. So if we can get a documentary out of that, that would be pretty special.
That definitely would be great. I would look forward to that, Howie. That's for sure. And possible book signings coming up, folks. And as Howie had mentioned, all positive reviews on Amazon, so 5 stars, just great, tremendous reviews on the book. So you have to check this out. Even if you don't remember Sports Phone, it's a forerunner to WFAN and ESPN, all the big sports stations of today. And Howie, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. Again, best of luck with this tremendous book. Again, folks, the title is 976-1313, How Sports Phone Launched Careers and Broke New Ground. Thanks again, Howie.
My pleasure, Bill. Anytime.
That's Howie Carpin, ladies and gentlemen. Up next, we be taking care of business with Randy Backman. Stick around, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we are back with Sports Talk New York on WGBB Radio here in Merrick, Long Island, New York. I want to thank you for tuning us in. And I hope you're enjoying the show tonight. We're going to switch gears one more time. Our next guest, he was a founding member of the Guess Who and the Backman-Turner Overdrive. He has a tremendous auction of the Randy Backman collection coming up on Wednesday, May 29th and Thursday, May 30th at the Hard Rock Cafe in New York City. It's being done by Julian's Auctions. You can find out more at Julian's Auctions, that's all one word, .com, and let's talk to the man himself. Welcome to the show tonight, Randy Backman. Randy, good evening.
Hi, good evening. It's nice to be talking to you and all the guys in Long Island.
Oh, yeah. We just had, you know Rusty Anderson?
Yes.
Yeah, we just had him on a couple of guests ago. A good guy and a good guitar player, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Randy, I want to talk to you about some of the items that we're going to see in the auction. One of them is the 1959 Gibson Les Paul Standard. That's known as the American Woman guitar. Tell us about that, X.
Well, I got it in 1967. It was very, very heavy to play, but also it has a very, very heavy sound. And when I was recording American Woman with a Guess Who, I was playing the rhythm just on a normal Fender guitar. It starts out with a Fender. And we wanted something on top without being too loud, but that had its own sound. And when I played that Les Paul, out came this tone, and it's almost like doo-doo-doo, almost like you'd be singing it. It has a big Bixby vibrato on it, but the guitar has such a thick, dark sound. It just sat on top of the track. And then before we knew it, that track was number one song in America in all three trades. We had Record World, Cashbox, and Billboard at the time, and the number one album, and that became known as the woman tone on a guitar, along with Eric Clapton having the same tone in I Feel Free and a lot of his stuff in the early Bean, the Beano album and stuff. And that's kind of like, that follows around a 59 Les Paul. The 58 and 9 and 60 Les Pauls were different than any others made because the glue they used on to glue the body and the neck together.
Ah, okay, understood. Now, didn't you have a guitar with a cracked neck that this replaced?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a playing on stage, a rickety stage made out of hardwood. The top fell off of my amp onto my guitar and broke it in half.
Oh, man.
Broke the neck in half. So I got a spare guitar, a Mosrite guitar, Mosrite, a Joe Mafus, which is kind of a country guitar, and I was playing it on stage. And a kid walked just in a church, in the basement of a church, which doesn't have a high ceiling. So the stage was maybe 6 inches high, just a little platform on the floor. Uh-huh. And I'm on stage singing, and a kid walks in with a little brown case. So when you're a guitar player, you know what a little brown case is. It's either machine gun or 59 Les Paul,
yeah.
Right? Or tweed case is an old Fender guitar, right?
Yeah.
And he put the guitar at my feet, right under the stage, and I'm singing the first song. And he opens it up, and I look down, and it's this Sunburst 59 Standard Les Paul, and I go, OMG. And he points at it, and he points at me. And I go, yeah. So right in the middle of the song, I take off my guitar, hand it to him. He hands me that, and I play it all night long, and it is amazing.
Yeah.
And at the end of the night, he comes and he says, I say to him, thank you very much, great. I give it back, and he says, you mean you don't want to trade? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I asked you if you wanted to trade, and you said yes. I said, well, I couldn't hear you. I was singing and playing.
Yeah.
I thought you just asked me if I wanted to play. Yeah, I want to play. And he said, well, I want to trade it to you. I don't want this guitar. I want the one you're playing. It's like the Ventures. It's like the Joe Mathis Mosrite guitar.
Yeah.
I said, oh, well, that's not a fair trade. I have some money in my pocket. I'll give you all the money I've got in my pocket. So I traded him this guitar and all the money I had in my pocket, which was $78.
Wow.
And that guitar went on to be played on No Time. All the Guess Who hits played on BTO. It's a solo in Let It Ride on in BTO.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a low part in Let It Ride. It's a solo in Rolling Down the Highway. And it was so heavy that I stopped playing it. I only played in the studio, sitting on a chair. Never took it on stage. So when you look at this guitar right now for auction, it looks brand new. I haven't played it on stage since 1971, since American Woman.
Wow, yeah, that's a great piece, folks. Check that out on the website. Take a look at that guitar. That is amazing. Now, another one that's going up for auction, Randy, is a 1955 white Fender Stratocaster, and you used that in multiple performances as well.
I did. I went to a back doctor, and I had a bad back. You know, imagine playing a Les Paul that weighed 14 and a half pounds.
Yeah.
Putting that on your shoulder for 3 or 4 hours a night, every night for years and years. I go to a back doctor. He says, okay, you got a blown back, do these exercises and stop playing guitar. I said, that's not going to happen. I went into a music store and said, what is the lightest guitar you have in weight? And they said, oh, we got a 54 Strat. And it's very, very light. The early Strats were really light. And so I took that white Strat with me to play neck. I think the serial number is 0212. It's one of the first Strats made, 5455. Mm-hmm. And then I played that in BTO because it's much lighter. So that's the rhythm on Let It Ride, Hey You, it's all the guitar. I'm looking out for number one. It's some of the guitar in some of the songs because I played the Les Paul and others on the solos. Back in those days, you never had foot pedals. You had one amp and maybe three guitars, a Fender, a Gibson, and a Gretsch. And that's how you got different tones on your records. Or one would play rhythm, the other would play lead, so you wouldn't be masking each other's frequencies. Mm-hmm. So all these guitars of mine now are going up for sale because during COVID, I had four houses in the world, one in London, one in Santa Monica, one in Toronto, and one in Salt Spring Island near Vancouver. And suddenly in COVID, I can't travel anymore for 3 years. So I had all my guitars and everything shipped to me, and suddenly I end up with like 250 guitars. I don't know where to put them. You have to rent, rent a warehouse, and you got to go visit your own guitars. You need visiting rights for your guitars.
Yeah.
So the time came to let the kids leave home and hope somebody adopts them and gives them a good new home, and they go on making hit records and playing number one albums and singles and solos. So they're going up for auction in a couple of weeks, and Hard Rock Cafe, and I'm looking forward to the auction because Clapton has sold a bunch. Mark Knopfler sold his. Mine is probably the last 59 Les Paul to come up for sale that hasn't been circulated around the world. I've had it since 1967.
Amazing, yeah. Again, that's auction, folks, is at Julian's. And juliansauctions.com will give you the details on all these great guitars. We're speaking to Randy Backman tonight on the program. Now, your main stage and recording guitar in the Backman Turner Overdrive was the 68 Fender Strat in white. Yeah. Tell us about that guitar.
Well, when in the old days, when you're on the road, I've been on the road. Okay, when you're on the road, you're on 300 days a year. When you buy something, you have to buy two of them. Because if it breaks, you can't go back to the place you were 2 weeks ago and get it again. You're in a different part of the country. So I bought two guitars that were very similar. When you break a string on one and your tech hands you the spare guitar, you can't have a different sound in the middle of a song or guitar string.
Right.
But I always have two Fenders, two Gibsons, two fuzz pedals, two overdrive pedals. One breaks, you've got the spare. So in a couple, part of the auction would be selling foot pedals from the 70s that are brand new because I bought two of each. One is still in the box with the directions and stuff. But this other extra strap was my main strap because on a normal strap, when you break a string, it's totally out of tune. This one has the strings through the body like a Telecaster. You break a string, the other five are in tune, you can finish the song. So those two white straps were basically a lot of the sound of BTO, and like I said, Let It Ride, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, are both of those Strat guitars playing rhythm at the same time. And so they don't mask each other because the 54 is very, very bright and thin in sound, and the 61 is much more mellower with a nice jangle. You put the two together, you have an unmatched guitar sound that you can't get with one guitar.
Right. And as you said, Randy, the Strats took the place of your 59 Les Paul because of the 14-pound weight and took some stress off your back.
Yeah, the Strats were under 8 pounds.
Yeah, that's a difference.
Yeah.
Now, black 59 Fender Strat. I read that it took you 30 years to acquire that guitar.
It did. It came into Winnipeg when I was I had gotten my Gretsch. Neil Young had gotten his Gretsch. And it was the first Stratocaster in Winnipeg with black, like Eric Clapton's Blackie. And I lusted after that guitar and finally got it from George Johns, who's a radio broadcaster in the States now. George Johns, you might have heard of him.
Yeah.
And he had a band called the Phantoms. And I bought it from him after, I think it's a 58 or 59 Strat. It's all black. It's all absolutely original. So if you're a Stratocaster collector, this black 59 is El Minto. There's nothing has been changed. It's just amazing. And it's wonderful to play, but I've got maybe 25 of them, and I've got maybe 25 Les Pauls. And so it's just, like I said, time to let them go.
Yeah. Thin out the herd. Let somebody else enjoy them. That's a way to go. Randy Backman with us tonight. Now, your collection, they're really museum quality. And tell us about the German guitars that are on the auction block.
Well, they were made after the war by guys in Germany who had trained at the Cremona factory in Italy where they made Stradivari instruments, you know, cellos, viola. They even made a few Stradivari guitars.
Wow.
So these guys trained at the Stradivarius factory, and they come back after the war. It's like the late 40s, early 50s, and all the symphony houses are bombed. They're all destroyed by the war, and so there's no symphonies for quite a few years. But they all were Django Reinhardt kind of guys playing gypsy jazz guitars. So these guys start to make archtop guitars. This is before Gibson went into big production. So I've seen pictures of a grandfather and his son, the father and the grandson, making these one guitars at a time out of wood from the Black Forest with all kinds of stuff they could buy on the black market, the abalone trim, the pearl trim, the ivory trim, everything then when nothing was illegal. You could have rosewood and black ebony fretboards and all that kind of stuff. And they put together these guitars and sell them to get enough money to buy more wood and more pieces, and they feed their family. And these were made one at a time. And if you look at them, they're absolute works of art the way they're put together. If you Google that website, the Randy Bachman Guitar Auction or Julian Auction, you'll see these guitars. There's over 100 of them that are real museum quality. And I know there's a couple of them. They're called the Bianca, a Hoyer Bianca. And there's one in the Getty Museum for $90,000 and one in the other museum in New York City, same thing, for $95,000. And that was a price I got 15 years ago. So these guitars are worth a lot. They're like works of art made out of wood and sweat, and you'll never see anything like them in your lifetime. They're all one of a kind Van Goghs in a way.
Yeah, it's art you can play.
Yes. And they're great if you're shooting a video, because nothing else, these are one of a kind in the world. There's no others like them.
That's great to know. Again, folks, check out the auction site, juliansauctions.com. Check out these great guitars. Now, you mentioned Django Reinhardt. Was he a influence on you, Randy?
He was, and you know who follows his footsteps? Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath. They played with two fingers.
Right.
Unbelievable. Here we are with 10 fingers. We can't play like these guys who are playing with two fingers. If you ever see a thing of Tony playing or Django Reinhardt playing, it's amazing the way these two fingers moved on their left hand. Just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I remember talking to Denny Lane, and he mentioned Django as one of his influences as well, the late Denny Lane. Now there was a 1960 Hoyer Special SL electric guitar, archtop. You called it one of the most elaborate of all your Hoyer Special SLs due to the color and due to the multi-ply rope binding.
Yes, it's so ugly, it's beautiful. You know what I mean? There's nothing like it. And they call it a clown guitar. And I said, why is it called a clown guitar? They said, well, in the 50s, because the guitar is from the 50s, there was nothing in Europe. There was no television. There was hardly any radio. Everything was banned. People went to circuses. The whole family went to the circus, the big top. We did, remember, Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. We would go to the circus. There'd be a parade down the, and you'd follow it, and you'd go into the tents and see everything. So the main greeter at the circus, the ringmaster, would also dress up and be the clown. And he would wear a plaid suit and polka dot hat and just so he would stand up. And he had these things called clown guitars that were red and white and silver and gold and sparkle that looked and sounded great, but they were made by the Hoyer guys who were making these incredible jazz guitars. And these were bought by early British musicians who were going to Germany, like the Beatles and David Bowie. There's one of them, the Bianca, that has the sound holes in it are lightning bolts cut into the top of the guitar.
I see that one.
Picture of David Bowie in Aladdin Sane with that actual guitar, and it's there for auction at Julian. I got five of them.
Wow. Yeah, amazing, Randy. Now, your first guitar, tell us about that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Sears catalog, $34.95.
Wow.
A Harmony FO guitar. I bought it, and I learned to play, you know, I Walk the Line and Hound Dog and Wake Up Little Susie and Bye Bye Love. And then I dropped it at my cousin's 10th birthday party in a top crack. I took it home, and I was building model airplanes at the time. I glued the top together with airplane glue, still in the same form. And then I realized nobody could hear this guitar, so I got an electric one from Sears for $79. I still have that guitar. And then my next guitar was a really big rock and roll guitar, a 1957 Gretsch Orange Chet Atkins Special that Duane Eddy played and Eddie Cochran played at the time. So I got one just like that. And then that was stolen from my hotel room in 1976, and I found it 47 years later in Japan, and went to Japan 2 years ago and got it on Canada Day, July the 1st. So I got my first real big rock and roll Gretsch guitar back.
Oh, that is amazing, Randy. That is a great story. Now, I can see that one with that looks like a violin. Sears, of course, supplied everybody when we were younger with almost anything we needed. So we know that the Sears catalog used to come at Christmas and there'd be everything in it. Now, the Silvertone and Harmony guitars, tell us about those.
Well, it's amazing. If you look at an early picture, any blues guy, I mean, Muddy Waters, B.B. King, whatever, Junior Blind Chicken, whatever you want to call them, all their guitars are from Sears. They're either called Harmony or a Silvertone. I mean, Sears brand of the record player and everything was a Silvertone. So the guitars are either Silver. Dan Electro made a lot of them. And all these guys' first guitars, like mine, was from the catalog. There was no such thing when I was growing up as a guitar store. There was a music store that sold pianos, organs, celestes, violin bows, rosin for the bows. They sold every instrument there was. And once in a while, they'd get a guitar. Now it's also there's actual guitar stores with 30 or 40 or 50 different brands of guitars.
Right.
But in those days, they said everybody got their stuff from Sears. And like you said, as a young kid, we couldn't wait to get to the back part where the ladies' lingerie was. I mean, that was like a big deal. This was way before Playboy magazine. We would get the Sears catalog.
That was
the deal.
And
all the women in their Sears panties and the swimsuits, besides the guitars and the toys, right?
Yeah, that's true, Randy. Oh, man, brings back a lot of memories. But did you tell us about the Stradivari school style?
About that guitar?
Yeah.
Well, there was a guy named Walter Lang, L-A-N-G,
right,
in Germany, who made these handmade guitars. There was quite a few guys. I collect four or five of those brands. And he passed away. And in Germany, you know, there's a lot, same thing in England, a lot in the Netherlands countries. You had your shop on the main floor, and you lived above your shop. Where you didn't have to pay double rent. You just went downstairs, neighbors are, there you work. I mean, a lot of New York is like that too, the people that moved over. You live above the store, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And so somebody, looking at the Stradivari people and who made the Stradivarius guitars and all these stuff, found this guy's house somewhere in Germany and went and knocked on the door. And the widow answers the door. And he said to her, is this where so-and-so lives? Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Can we see his workshop? Yes, you can. He passed away in 1961 or something like that. And they go in there, all the wood there on the bench. And he said to the widow, she said, I haven't been down here in a long, 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 long time.
Yeah.
He said, can I buy all the stuff? Do you need any money? And he bought all the tops and all the sides of these guitars, which are cured from the 50s on. I mean, talk about wood that has been properly cured and dried. And he made it in a Stradivari thing. So there's a guitar there that looks just like a Stradivarius. It's finished like a Stradivarius, but he wouldn't paint it. I want it to be white. He said, no, this wood is honored to be just sort of rubbed with like an oil, and it's going to look like a cello or a viola or a violin.
Yeah.
And so I've got one of those. It was custom made by the guy in the Netherlands for me. I was in London at the time, and I said, will you send me this guitar? He said, no, I won't. I won't send it on an airplane. You must come and get it. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, fly on this airline. They do all the FedEx flying and UPS flying. You can get a seat on the airplane for like £10. So just fly here and pick it up. And then buy a seat going home. You'll get the whole guitar there for $50. But you'll carry it in your arm and you buy a seat for it. I said, wow, that's big time.
Yeah.
So I flew there with my wife and got it. Went to his shop. His name was Theodore. And the guitar is there for sale. And he made a tree of life on the neck. He put my initials RB are on the headstock and on the 12th fret, and it's an amazing guitar. But I can't play these guitars anymore because of the same thing Mark Knopfler and Clapton and Brian May. We're all having trouble with our fingers, our shoulders, playing 40 years of guitar in your left shoulder, and your right shoulder is all kind of screwed up. And so we're going to lighter guitars, and we have to let the big ones go, and hopefully we get guys who love them and cherish them because they are really special.
They're treasures, Randy, that's for sure. Now, you have an Epiphone Les Paul signed by Bob Seger.
I do. I got many signed guitars by friends of mine. Back when BTO hit number one, Bruce Allen, who was our manager at the time, said, who do you want to open? This is a BTO number one tour. And I said, Bob Seger. He said, who? I said, Bob Seger. He's got two songs I love, Ramblin' Gamblin' Man and 2+2 Is On My Mind. You'll find him in a bar somewhere in Michigan.
Yeah.
So Bruce Allen went and found him. And he opened 252 dates for BTO over 2 years. And then his record labels started noticed his catalog selling, and Warner Brothers reactivated his catalog, and so did Capitol, and suddenly Bob Seger becomes huge. And he asked me to produce him, and I can't, because I'm producing BTO, and I'm on the road with BTO. So I turned Bob Seger onto Jack Richardson, who was my producer in The Guest Who, and produced American Woman in These Eyes and all our hits. So Jack Richardson ends up being Bob Seger's producer.
Ah, yeah. He's a tough autograph, too, Randy. I don't know if you know that, but, yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's tough to get, because I collect, and Bob Seger is rough, but it's like the white whale to get a hold of Bob Seger and Tom Petty. That's my that's my white whale.
I went to his show in Toronto a few years ago, and he signed it and gave it to me. I got one signed by B.B. King on my birthday,
wow.
And on my birthday, about 5 years ago, I was playing the Invictus Games in Toronto for Prince Harry, and I was with Back with Turner, so we're the closing act. Our next act was Bruce Springsteen. Our next act before that was Brian Adams, and one before that was Kelly Clarkson. And it's my birthday, so I get called into Bruce Springsteen's dressing room, and I go, what? The boss wants to see me. I go in there, and he says, happy birthday, man. And he hands me his Telecaster, just like his signed to me, happy birthday. So
wow.
Thank you very much to the boss, to Bruce Springsteen. Yes.
You have that one up for auction, Randy, or are you keeping
that
one?
I do. No, it's there. I'd love to keep them, but when I was playing these, I'm going to be playing them. I'm coming to New York on Tuesday. I'm going to be doing special shows where I'm playing these and telling the stories on them. Then they're auctioned the following week. It's really hard to let them go. It's like, it's like your childhood. It's like your mother saying, "Hey, guess what? I'm giving away your Superman comic books." You say, "What?" Well, she said, "You haven't read them in 30 years. You go home, they're worth some money, but they're worth your childhood memories to you." I remember trading comic books with kids, and then you ended up trading 45s when you bought a record.
Yeah.
I would learn both sides and trade my friend a 45 to learn both sides of that. We would trade records. And these things are precious to you because they become who you are. You learn to play music from these, or you learn to be a writer or an artist because you've read Superman, or you know what I mean? You love the superhero. So all this stuff is very important. It's really tough to let it go. It really is.
I understand, Randy. Yeah. Now, Darren Julian, who is the co-founder, executive director of Julian's Auction, says, Randy Bachman's music is some of the most recognizable and indelible in all of rock and roll history. And here we have some of his most famous and legendary guitars that are not only instruments, but as we've discussed with Randy, true works of art assembled in one of the finest guitar collections that will ever come to auction. And again, I want to repeat for the folks out there, Randy, there'll be a special exhibition in New York for the public to view highlighted items, as we discussed tonight, prior to the auction, May 22nd to May 28th at the Hard Rock Cafe. Julian's Auctions public exhibition and live auction location, Hard Rock Cafe, 1501 Broadway in Times Square, Wednesday, May 22nd to May 28th. It's free to the public to come in and check this out. But the auction, the live and online auction, May 29th and 30th. It's a Wednesday and Thursday. Starts at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. There's a couple of ways to place your bids. If you go to Julian's Auctions website, they'll tell you. You can bid online, bid over the phone, bid in person if you're there, and bid in advance by absentee bid. And some great, great items as we discussed with Randy tonight. And you're coming into town when, Randy?
I'm coming in Tuesday, and I'm doing a special show Wednesday night for select people. I'll be doing all kind of media stuff all next week. I'm going to go see the Stones Thursday night, Yahoo.
Nice.
I haven't seen them in a while. And I'm looking forward to New York. It's been a long time since I've been there. And I would tell everybody, if they're coming to the free look viewing, bring your camera. If you can't afford a guitar, you can at least take a picture of them, because they are one of a kind.
That's nice to allow people to photograph them, Randy, too. That's a great idea for folks that can't afford this, because these things are going to go for big money because they're worth big money. That is for sure. Now, your favorite BTO song to play, Randy, what is that?
Oh, my goodness. Well,
it's like asking, who's your favorite kid, right?
My two anthems are You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet and Taking Care of Business. So you pick.
I can't pick either. Those are two great ones. Now, do you still do your show on the Beatles channel?
I do. My son and I love doing it. And we're going to the big Beatles convention in July. It's Chicago, their anniversary of playing Soldier's Field. But we do the thing on Sirius, and we love doing it.
Yeah, tell folks when that is on, Randy.
Well, it's on Sirius Beatles channel. And it's on different times of the four or five times a week at 2 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon. It's for all the truck drivers and people who are driving around. So the schedule kind of changes, but we do a different show every month. And I grew up with the Beatles. I toured as Ringo Starr in 1995 for the whole year with John Entwistle and me and Billy Preston, all in the Ringo's band.
Nice, and, yeah, that's the all-star band.
The Beatles changed our life, and I tell how it changed my life. My son, Cal, was like 25 years younger than me. When he was born, I was 25.
Yeah.
He grew up on my Beatles stuff. I mean, I'd go on tour with BTO, and I'd come home, and all my Beatles records would be all over the living room, and I'm supposed to tear a strip off of him, because they're laying on the floor.
Yeah.
A little voice in my head says, don't say a word to him.
Yeah.
But be kind. So I'd say, well, Cal, you're listening to all these records. He goes, yeah, and they changed my life. Here, listen to this, Dad. And the voice in my head says, the kid is getting the same education that you got.
Right.
He's listening to the Beatles, the greatest songwriters and composers in the world. They changed pop music. They went from Love, Love Me Do, You Know I Love You, to Tomorrow Never Knows and Strawberry Field. They took the world on such a trip through rock and roll and doo-wop and psychedelia and adding symphonies and stuff. They're the most incredible band in the world.
In seven years, Randy.
When I got to do that show and to tour with Ringo Starr, it's literally a dream come true. So Cal and I talk as real fans. And to get a fan letter from Peter Asher and a phone call from Paul McCartney or something saying they love the show, it just makes it all really cool.
Outstanding. Well, Randy Bachman, we thank you for taking time out of your Sunday evening to spend it with us here in New York. I wish you the best with the auction. Once again, folks, this is the legendary Randy Bachman collection. Go to juliansauctions.com for more info. Take a look at the great gear from Randy up for bids. We wish you all the best, Randy. Thanks again.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
That's Randy Bachman, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guests, Noah Gittell, Rusty Anderson, Howie Carpin, and, of course, Randy Bachman, my engineer, Brian Graves, and you guys for joining us. I'll see you next on June 2nd. Till then, be safe, be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.